This is Edge Cases, a podcast about mostly Apple-related software development, featuring myself and my co-host, the Abbott and Costello of Objective-C. I'm Andrew Pontius.
And I'm Will French.
This is episode 24. It's Friday, October 26th, 2012. And are you ready for our topic this week, Wolf?
Bated breath.
Topic this week is miscellaneous follow-up.
Okay.
How's that for a topic, right?
Okay, so, potpourri, gotcha.
So it will include some thoughts on storyboards and exception safety, among others. So we're recording on Friday, not Saturday. Not my normal Saturday, because I'm busy tomorrow, and it's been a busy week for me, so I didn't have a lot of time to prepare one big topic. Also, I got a little hooked on a game called Letterpress. Have you heard of this game, Wolf?
I have heard of it.
Yes. So it is a word game by Lauren Brichter, who wrote Tweety, which is a popular Twitter client that was eventually acquired by Twitter and killed, basically.
It was actually, I guess it is the most popular Twitter client.
Right, but they,
I mean,
they
if you assume of, that, yeah, assuming that it's the same heritage, I'm assuming that Lava's Code is still pulsing through the veins of the official Twitter app, even though the skin is different nowadays.
Well, from what I've heard, they have replaced either the iPhone or the iPad version basically with a web view.
Oh, so, wow.
And it makes sense because Twitter is going to be going towards sort of a unified view,
right,
which is very different from what most of the clients do. So in any case, he eventually left Twitter, and this is the first thing he's done since then. So I have found it to be quite addictive. And if we have some time, which you probably won't, but if we do, I'll talk about the UI a little bit at the end of the podcast. All right, so you've probably noticed that the opening has changed again. I'm still not quite satisfied with it.
I just think of the opening as like Murphy Brown's secretary.
I don't get that reference. I remember the show. I didn't watch Murphy Brown. Did she, that secretary change each episode?
In every episode, there was a different secretary. And at the end, inevitably fired, he or she.
Yeah. Well, it's sort of like I was listening to the Incomparable podcast talking about Spinal Tap. So it's like the drummers, where the drummers always combust. So I'm kind of trying to make it a little more of the jaunty style that I've heard in various 5x5 podcasts, such as Build and Analyze and Hypercritical. But I don't think ours still sounds that great. And I've shortened it since last week, if you noticed. But I think it doesn't sound that great, probably because we don't have music underneath it. And so music is not in our immediate future. I don't remember if we've talked about this before, but it still may be in our future. I live in hope. And so hopefully after more experimentation, our intro will be ready for such music if and when it does appear. And I'll probably keep fiddling with it.
Okay.
Now, the biggest change that started last week and continued into this week is, for example, for last week, I mentioned the Statler and Waldorf of Objective-C. And now that isn't my formulation, and we'll get to that in a second. But Statler and Waldorf, now, of course, you're familiar with Statler and Waldorf. I do wonder if our audience is entirely familiar with them.
I had to Google it, but once I saw it, I'm like, oh, of course, those guys.
So the Wikipedia article about them was in the show notes last week, and we didn't discuss it because we thought Wilf would need all the time of the episode to talk about Design by Contract, but he did not. Mm-hmm. And so the Statler and Waldorf are Muppets. They appear in The Muppet Show, which ran from the late 70s to the early 80s. I'm not going to describe entirely what The Muppet Show is. The link will be in the show notes for you to go through it. But I thought of the phrase, or I thought to use the phrase, because it was used on Twitter by Justin Williams. And if you don't know who Justin Williams is, he's a pretty famous blogger. You can go to carpeaqua.com. which has been linked to by Daring Fireball and elsewhere. Link in the show notes, as usual. So this month, Justin Williams tweeted, I love you guys because you're the Statler and Waldorf of Objective-C. And I responded at the time, and I pointed him back to a tweet from mine from July, which I think you remember, Wolf.
I did.
I said, serious question of myself and Wolf, who's Statler and who's Waldorf? Now, it's incongruous because he didn't say, like, the Statler and Waldorf of podcasts. Right?
Mm-hmm.
He didn't say of Coco or of Coco developers. No, he said it of a language, right? So I think it's funny. So now one of the things here is I would put a link to this tweet in the show notes, but Justin actually has already deleted it. Did you know that?
I did.
So he he uses Twitter very differently than I use Twitter. he apparently has decided that responses to people are not something that he wants to have in his Twitter stream or something. So he
didn't. I can kind of understand that because I view this as a UI failing of Twitter that actually there are kind of in the process of correcting where, you know, when you think about it, you know, you go look at a Twitter profile and you say, well, should I follow this person? And like, okay, I'll look at the types of things they tweet because then I'll see if it's timeline worthy. Right. And unfortunately, if you use Twitter conversationally, is just your timeline is just littered with that, all these at mentions that that often are people who you'll never see in your timeline. Right. I know on some of the like verified accounts or other accounts, they actually allow you to have a filter where you don't see the at mentions. That by default, you actually just see the non at mentions posts, the ones that are meant to just be broadcast to everyone.
Yeah.
And so I'm thinking it's a way to do that, or maybe he just is running some sort of financial scam and he wants to clean up his paper trail.
That would be the other option of the two options that are available for us to believe.
He is the Enron of Twitter.
Yeah. Well, yes. So Justin Williams is an interesting man. You should definitely read his blog post to find out more about his, especially his interesting recent history in the Cocoa community. But while it's a funny reference, it's not entirely positive, right? If you look at the Statler and Waldorf Wikipedia page, they describe them as two disagreeable old men, right? So they're basically hecklers. They sit in the balcony and make jokes about all the skits on the show. They are felt trolls, I think would be one way of putting it. So they make fun of everybody else, but quote, they find themselves vastly entertaining and inevitably burst into mutual laughter at their own witticisms.
That is so us.
So, all right, we'll take it, right? Sure. But that being said, as you'll notice this time around, I actually used a different duo. And I have found when I thought about it that I kind of like that whole duo member one and duo member two of Objective-C formula. So unless I change my mind, and that's possible, I'll be using that as the intro, and I have a long list of duos, so I won't be running out of duos to use anytime soon.
Okay.
And so I've also put Abbott and Costello, the Wikipedia page for that on there too, because of course they're even older. But hopefully more people will get that reference as well.
I think I've seen some fragments of that, but in the depth of my pop culture tends to be kind of, 80s, 70s, 80s, 90s, and aughts, I guess.
Sure.
So it's I think I could recognize them in a lineup, but it's definitely, I would have to, in order to go deeper and to really understand the comparison, I think I would need to see a clip again or something.
Sure. Well, then that's your homework. but you did remember, you did know the names.
I did
recognize the names. Sure.
Yeah.
Okay. So that's it for the opening. On to the second follow up piece, which is about app code. So in episode 12, which he did in August, right? Beginning of August, the episode's entitled "A Little Slice of Windows in My IDE." I talked about the app code IDE by JetBrains, and I talked about what it was and what it did, and I was not really entirely complimentary. It was not really a recommendation for people, but it turns out that someone I know from NS Coder Night in San Francisco took my mention of it in the podcast as an occasion to try it out. So it actually turns out that this was enough of an impetus to get her to try it. She's been using Xcode for a couple of years already to do Cocoa development, to do iOS development. But before that, she used IntelliJ IDE.
Oh, okay. So it would be a little bit coming home for her.
Right. Well, you would think that she would be the perfect candidate to use it because, of course, AppCode is really just IntelliJ repurposed to do something new. Most of the logic comes from the original application. And so she has a blog post about it, which I'll put in the show notes. And she goes into the pros and cons in some detail, which I won't be doing. But one thing I thought was interesting is that the keyboard shortcuts for AppCode don't match the ones in IntelliJ.
Hmm.
So instead she had to switch to using the Xcode shortcuts because she was more familiar with the Xcode shortcuts at this point and could get used to the same kind of shortcuts in AppCode rather than sort of the mismatched ones, that should have matched up to what IntelliJ had.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm curious why they would do that, why they would make the non-Xcode shortcuts different, you know, because the whole point you would think would be to bring someone like that into the fold, back into the fold. So I'd be curious about that. I wonder, wonder if we'll find out. But it is, but the other part of this is that no publicity is bad publicity, right? That, and it makes sense. The demo for AppCode is free, so it's not really a cost issue, at least to get people to try it. It's an attention issue. So if I bring it to our audience, and let's say, for the sake of argument, we have 100 people listening to us, and I turn, you know, 97 of them off from AppCode by not really recommending it, well, there might still be 3 people who then want to try it, because let's say, you know, they used JetBrains before, they don't like me for some reason, but still listen to the podcast. They disagree with me a lot. So those 3 people are then 3 extra people who are going to try it out, who wouldn't have tried it out before. So, well, win. Woo.
Is this the story you're going to tell the advertisers?
Well, that was what I was thinking, right? Like, you know, you could make the argument then that, well, you might want to pay us less if we're trashing your product, but you still might want to pay us. Yeah, I probably need to work on that pitch a little bit.
Isn't that the Yelp business model?
The what business model?
The Yelp business Yelp. Model.
Do they only say good things?
Where you get reviews and so you have a restaurant or whatever, and you get reviews, and then they come knock on your door and they say, "Hey, you know, nice business you got here. I see you got some bad all reviews right. here. Mm-hmm. Wouldn't you like to just kind of make those like the worst review just kind of go away?"
So the mob, basically, yeah. We're probably not up to Corleone status just yet among podcasts, but you know, if we ever are, we get a corner on the market. We could try that out. I'll leave you in charge of that piece. So okay, and then the next one after that, just that little bit on AppCode there, is getting back to storyboard files. So we oohed and aahed about storyboard files during my last episode, episode 22, Nibs and Dibs and Storyboards, oh my. But neither one of us had actually used it very much. Now, continuing this theme of me not having a whole lot of time to prepare for this episode, I actually still haven't used them that much, but I have a little bit more information. And so, to start off with, I'll say something that I believe I said last time around, which is the idea that even in the format that we saw them in, there's still the serialization of an object graph. Now, I remember us mentioning a couple times in that last episode that it was more than that, that it was a bit more intermediated, if that's a word, that there was a bit more thought being placed into how you go from the objects to the file. But in the end, it really still is a file of objects. And the common diffing algorithms, again, as I said in that episode, of Git and Subversion and pretty much everybody else, are instead stream-based, where what they do is they just compare byte after byte of one file to another file or one file to a modified file and see if there are any differences in that stream as you go along. And because of this mismatch, you're always going to have problems with these kind of files. That it's always going to be ugly to deal with them. Now, it would be interesting if, say, Git or other systems like this had a pluggable diffing engine. And I bet some of them do. Somebody has to, right? Because if you had a pluggable engine and you could have, say, a plugin for storyboard files or zip files or anything else, then someone could go through and write that logic to say, well, okay, now I'm going to compare those two trees and find the things that are different and find where things have been moved and find where things have been added, etc., and give you an intelligent diff of those contents, of the differences between those contents. Wouldn't that be great?
Yeah, if you could compare object graphs, you know, as deserialized object graphs, that'd be awesome.
That would be awesome. Now, maybe making a more Waldorf-style comment, of course, that's not going to happen. Because, as I believe we discussed again in the last episode, because these file formats are not public, they are not documented, it's going to be pretty hard to convince someone that they should spend a lot of time making this plugin when there's just not that much they can get out of it. And it's likely to break every time they add new stuff in, which they are. They're adding new stuff in quite frequently these days. So I don't think it's going to happen for storyboards. But I do know of one code base that is doing this. which is, or at least that I've heard is doing this, which is Core Data and iCloud. In that the way that you can have a Core Data file that is synced in iCloud is that it will actually go through and compare the contents rather than just do a stream comparison. Have you heard about this, Wolf?
Yeah, that's. I know there's like two basic ways of using Core Data with iCloud, and that's the fine-grained way.
I heard there were sort of three ways. Are you considering the prefs to be?
Oh, right. Yeah.
But in any case, so I've heard that people have had difficulty with it, and I don't know offhand whether the difficulty is that it's buggy or that it's just a hard to use API. If they have done it, and if they've done it well, then certainly kudos to them for doing that. I suspect, though, that there are probably some edge cases that they don't handle that well yet, because it's just such a big problem. Like, you know, if you say, okay, so let's say you consider it to be a graph of objects, then you have to tell the difference between those two graphs. You have to be able to handle everything that could possibly meaningfully change between those two graphs. You have to handle things being moved, different relationships, things being renamed, let's say an entirely different tree being substituted for the one you have, with virtually nothing the same except maybe a couple of objects which have been stuck into different places now. How do you handle all that? And I think the way that they probably handle it is they probably handle the standard cases pretty well. But it would take a lot of time and who knows, maybe a lot of theory to get something that handles everything correctly. So I would suspect, completely making stuff up here, that's the kind of thing people are having problems with, that they try something that's just a little different than what Apple has tested themselves, and then that blows up, or it doesn't work. So I don't know. I would hope that it would work pretty well. I will probably not be trying it, you know, right away myself, but I'll be keeping an eye on it.
I will say that, I mean, if their implementation is, as I understand it, where assuming like a SQLite store,
yep.
I mean, if you're lucky, if you're really best case scenario there is that you persist the transaction laws and you ship them back and forth and then you try to reconcile the transaction laws. But SQLite's transaction log format is not designed for that use case. Yeah. I mean, it's good for when you're, you know, for the transaction log scenario that it's built for. But you try to synchronize two different databases with it. I mean, you can use kind of a standard heuristic fallback where where you fall back to, when in doubt, this duplicate data, and that will get you pretty far. But fundamentally, this is like the type of stuff that like CouchDB handles, and I don't think flat out there's enough information in the SQLite transaction log format to do this in the generic case. So yeah, they probably can handle maybe a majority of the cases, and maybe they can, with the heuristic of duplicating data is better than deleting data, and maybe with versions you can go back in time, but fundamentally it's bigger than that, assuming that that's the implementation they're using.
Right, and I think you've hit on something there, which is to say a general purpose implementation. Almost every app that I've seen that handles something like this is trying to handle it in their own very specific case. They're not trying to handle everything that you could possibly ever do in a general purpose case. And so, yeah, it's a big problem. Now, so if we say, okay, we say, well, no one's done this for diffing at this point, for the kind of things that we're talking about, storyboards. And so if we're not going to go the whole hog, can we do anything to make things better? To make this match made in hell of stream-based diffing and graph-based documents not suck so much. And it turns out that one model you can use for this is how Xcode handles it. And I don't think we've talked about this in any detail, so I'm going to talk about it a little bit here. The Xcode project file format, and this isn't the Xcode proj package, this is the actual project.pbx proj text file that's inside of that package, is also an object graph. And it's undocumented, it's a little hard to understand for people who aren't Xcode programmers. So it's not necessarily something where you can do a lot of spelunking on your own and make too much sense of it. But one thing that they did a bunch of years ago now, probably over 5 years, is they made a couple of formatting changes to the format to improve diffability. And I'm going to talk about two of them today. One is that they added labels in places where you didn't need labels. So the two places that I see just skimming an Xcode project, a very new Xcode project which doesn't have a lot of changes or a lot of content to it, is that they added section labels so that each list of files is labeled. So they have like begin PBX framework, what is it? PBX frameworks build phase section, and then end PBX frameworks build phase section. Begin PBX group section, begin XC configuration list section. They didn't really need to do this because they would know what order they put these things in there if they wanted to do that. But every time you put more text, where the text between the two documents, the two different versions of the document, are more the same, so that you've got more common text around the changes, that makes it easier for the diffing algorithm to piece things together better, to identify the changes in a meaningful way for you.
Right, they kind of form like an anchor.
Yeah. And the other place where they have labels that I saw was file labels. So if you look at these things inside the Xcode project file format, files are referred to by UUID, which is whatever, 16-digit letter and digit thing, which you're never going to remember yourself. They're not human readable. And they're not really diff readable either very well. But I looked at, again, in this sample that I looked at, there was a really long string of numbers and letters followed by info plist.strings. And then another one followed by main storyboard.storyboard. And so this means this anchors these numbers with the names of the files. And what this especially means, if I believe this is right, that you could even remove the file from Xcode and then add it back. And that's going to give it a different UUID, because they're not going to save those between changes like that. But if the file name is the same, well, then the diffing algorithm says, oh, yeah, this could still be the same if there are enough. If it's in about the same place and doesn't have that many other changes, it will be able to identify that better. And again, they didn't need to do that. They don't need it for their own uses inside of Xcode. They've got the UUID. But it does allow for more of these anchors. And it helps. It helps quite a bit. The other thing that they did is they added list delimiters at the end of lists. So normally if you have a comma-separated list, let's say you have four elements, you're going to then have a comma between 1 and 2, 2 and 3, 3 and 4, but you're not going to have one, let's say, before 1 or after 4, because you don't need them. But what they said here in Xcode was that the most common change you get in Xcode is you have two people adding files to the same place in the project file. And so those come across as a conflict. And normally what you'd want to do then is you want to say, we'll take both. We want to take this person's additions and this person's additions and just shove them both together. And if you do that where the last element does not have a comma after it, then it's not going to be readable as a file after you're done. Whereas if you add commas after every last element, everywhere in the file, that means you can do those sorts of merges and they'll work. They'll just automatically work. So that was a really nice, smart little change that they could make without needing to, you know, rewrite their code or write a plugin for project file diffing. Just something to make your life a little easier. And there is, what is it? So I didn't write it down, but I'll put it in the show notes. There's a tweet possibly by the same person who had the app code blog post, where she said that there's another post somewhere where they talk about how you can set something up in Git where for a particular file format, you can say always choose both sides, always merge whole, something like that. I don't remember exactly what it is anymore because I didn't write it down. But for that, then if you say to Git, well, do it that way. That way, then you don't have to mark it as a conflict when there's changes in the same place. You can just always take both. And then that means that you don't have to do any manual reconciliation at all. And so that's cool. And I've been meaning to try it, and I will do so. And I also want to let everyone else know as well. And again, the exact details of it will be in the show notes. Have you heard about this?
I have not, so that's news to me.
Now, it won't be a panacea if you say use both, and what you've done is remove one thing and add another thing, well, maybe that might work too, actually. There are probably cases where that will still fail, but certainly a lot fewer cases and a lot more of an edge case than the usual. Okay, so that's project files.
Okay, well, let me do an interjection here. Sure. Along the topic of the Core Data iCloud sync thing, because I couldn't remember what the term was, but did a little digging. And the thing I was referring to, that where I talk about where the SQLite transaction log format simply doesn't have enough data and isn't set up to do this type of stuff. Basically, Wikipedia is your friend here. You want to look at something called vector clocks, which is a way to have basically logical clocks that aren't tied to the wall clock, that they're logical and they kind of track causality. And the other thing is operational transforms. So you can basically, I learned about this from the author of Mockingbird, the prototype app that I mentioned, I think, a couple episodes ago or something like that.
Yeah.
But talked about how you do these real-time collaboration type stuff where just like that, you know, you have these basically an object graph of these visual elements on screen. And as one person is rotating a rectangle, you can be, you know, change its color. And so you express these in terms of operational transforms, and you ship these transforms to each other, and then you create convergence points. And you tie this all behind these types of vector clocks, and so each side hopefully gets to see what the other person is seeing without actually having to ship entire object graphs back and forth, and it also does a good job of synchronization. So yeah, that definitely needs to go in show notes. It's really cool stuff.
Is there a blog post about the specific approach they took on this?
No, unfortunately, this. I forget the guy's name, but he gave a talk at a Cappuccino conference a couple years ago, and to my knowledge, he never blogged it up. And unfortunately, they did shoot videos of it, but apparently there were a technical snafu, and so those videos were lost. So all I have is some audio notes from Pairnote, which is, by the way, Pairnote is an awesome app. I recommend that. I think I've mentioned it on my blog a couple times now. But so it has not been written up, but the Wikipedia page is pretty solid in terms of the theory behind it and some concrete implementations. And in fact, like things like Google Wave use this, and there is the Jupyter collaboration system that implemented this, and I think Groove also, something like this. So this is not a new idea. It's unfortunately not very widespread yet. And as we're running into these scenarios more and more, I suspect it is going to become more widespread.
Well, do you think that this is, and again, as I was saying, is this kind of a way to do merges, a way to set up your data very geared towards collaboration efforts then?
Exactly.
Yeah. Because that would seem to validate what I was saying about, you know, you want to pick areas to focus on for this sort of thing that are less than the entire case, that are not the general case, that are a specific case. And it sounds like they might have done that here. Wolf?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, okay. Cool. Yeah, you know, whatever links, we'll put them in the show notes. We'll put them in the show notes. Okay. So, wow. So even with not very long topics, we might not get to everything. So let's see. So there's... Let's see, storyboards or... Okay, so why don't we do storyboards then? And maybe I'll just leave the next one to the last topic to another time. So let's see, how far did I get with this stuff? I don't think I actually started. Okay, so storyboards. I didn't have time to do what I wanted to do, which was to test out diffing in full, because that was something that we hadn't tried before. But as I said, you know, so it's, okay, so getting back into the swing of things here. But you can imagine that there would be some complications with it because it is an object graph format. Now, it turns out that while I didn't have much of a chance to try that out, there are other issues with this which are not really a surprise. So the first thing I saw about storyboards was that it has the same kind of update rationale that Zibs have, which is not surprising, in that you can save a storyboard and it will sort of wrap up a whole bunch of other unrelated changes with whatever changes you're specifically making in the same way that Zibs do. So if your class hierarchy changes underneath you and when you're before you've changed Zib for some other reason, when you change Zib for a particular reason, it will then take those class hierarchy changes with them. Now, what I tried, therefore, was to take a storyboard that came with a default Xcode template, project template, and just save it again. See what happened. So as I suspected, there were changes that were made even without mine making any explicit changes. The system version changed from the one presumably that they used to originally make the template to the one that I'm on. And this is something that's actually quite interesting about a lot of these zip files is that they do interact very closely with the operating system, with the specific version of Cocoa that's involved, in ways that, you know, your project file, excuse me, your source code files don't need to because they're just regular text files. They did some interesting things with the labels. Now, I talked about there being labels in the Xcode project file format, which were there that didn't need to be there, that were just there to add a little bit of an anchor, a little bit of a readability improvement. And they shut that down a little bit with the version that I saw. There was, let's see, the class prefix colon identifier master view controller dash master. And in the new version, it's master view controller dash master. So they took out these sort of verbiage of class prefix, and they might have added it more in the end. I'll get to that in a second. Another interesting change was that they changed the size, the height of the view area. Now, this is an iOS app, iPhone app, and they changed the size, I believe, from iPhone 4 to iPhone 5. They increased the height. That's kind of interesting, right? That the, I guess somewhere in there's logic to say, well, from now on, we're going to use iPhone 5 height as the default height. So if you haven't set the height before, we'll just make it this new value. And then the other thing that I noticed that was a bit disappointing was that I saw in two places where the order of things changed.
Ooh, that's a bad one.
That's a bad one, right? That's exactly what we were talking about before, where if you don't order things in a defined way, you're going to get spurious changes, and that's what I saw here. And I saw it here without even making any of my own changes to it. So it may be that even though we wanted, you know, the world to be different, the world to be improved, that the storyboard file format does replicate some of the problems that zip files had. Now, I talked to you about the labels being a bit different, a bit of verbiage taken away from them. There is actually a new classes section at the end of the file. Now, this would make me think that with storyboards now, they are replicating, again, more of what Zibs did, where they have to have some sense of what your class hierarchy is. They have to save that with the file. It would be nice if they didn't have to save that with the file, because then that means fewer spurious changes when the class hierarchy changes. And you would think that they wouldn't necessarily need it, because they are, all you really need to know is what a class is at runtime. I don't know. I suppose we'll see.
Yeah, it strikes me as this is not something that should be persistent into either the zip or the storyboard format, because it is something that the indexer should inform you of, because they're doing that to basically to figure out what the IB outlets and the IB actions are, and maybe also for binding purposes. But of course, that's less of an issue in iOS. So that is, I mean, maybe this is. This comes back from the times when the Xcode indexer was, maybe you couldn't spin up right away or something, or maybe it wasn't fast enough and you wanted to open a project and immediately start editing. But it does seem to me that this is information that should not be in persisted.
Right. Or if it were persisted, like you could imagine that they would persist it somewhere else in a file that's kind of a throwaway file instead of something that they need, something that you're going to want to check in and merge over and over again. I don't know. Now, one of the reasons why I thought about this again was that someone had tweeted a week or two or three ago, and I can't find it again because Twitter search kind of sucks now, but someone talked about segue merging. And so if you look at a line which represents a segue, it's interesting that those lines do not have the same affordances, do not have the same extra pieces that other parts of the file format do. Specifically, segues do not have that textual label after them. So they don't have that anchor which says, well, here's what it actually is in addition to what, let's say, its ID is. And so that makes it harder to merge. So what I saw from this tweet was someone had a picture of like three segues and it was having trouble merging them because it didn't know which one to pick and they were all being changed in the same spot. And so that wasn't great. And that reminded me that I actually don't like the way segues have been set up all that much. So for actions, like for a button, you get to specify your own, you get to specify your own method to be used for that trigger. And I've always liked that. I've always liked the aspect of the runtime, the Cocoa runtime of Zibs, of Xcode, of the whole deal, because that meant that you could split the logic and put it wherever you wanted. And you didn't always have to bunch it up into one place. And that compares favorably with other Apple technologies like KVO. So in KVO, to observe the change in a path, you need to implement observe value for key path, colon, of object, colon, change, colon, context, colon. And so you'll see that method, that very ungainly method, littered throughout all of your classes. And then if you have a whole bunch of things to listen to, well, you've got to say, you know, if keypath equals blah, then do this. Or if it equals this, then do that. Or if it equals this other thing, then do this. So it's this clumsy gateway to the rest of the functionality of your application, which I've just never liked. There should really be a way to say, you know what, let's just match together this keypath with this method that's going to handle it. And so what you see here is with the segue, you see that same sort of clumsy gateway being replicated. So there's a method called prepare for segue, colon, sender, colon. And you have to do the same sort of thing. You say, you know, if segue identifier is equal to string, blah, 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 then do this. And if it's equal to this other string, then do this. I just don't like it.
Yeah, I've actually tangled a bit with segues myself last week, or actually this week, I don't know. So within the last 7 days. And I was surprised to learn that apparently the your destination, I guess, view, a view controller, that the IB outlets will not be hooked up for you. So, you know, you would think that if I want to set a text field on the next view side to something, that I would need to, like, say, you know, you get your prepare for segue, you get handed the segue, segue has the destination view controller, and you say, okay, I'll just grab the UI text field there and set its string value to what it should be, but that actually will be nil, so that would be a no operation. So you basically have to have these little, like, islands or way stations of instance variables that you can kind of jam in your view controller, and then the destination view controller will get the I don't know, so like something like awake from nib, where it says, okay, view did load, that's it. And then you can move off your little way station, copy those little values into your IB outlets, which are actually hooked up for you at that point.
Oh, that's awful. Oh, is that, oh my God. Wow. I feel like if we were actually Statler and Waldorf, we'd have a really pithy joke about that now, but I guess we don't. Okay, so that's bad. I mean, that's just plain bad.
It starts to make Zips look good.
Oh, don't say that. Well, the other thing I noticed just looking through this stuff is the destination view controller accessor is untyped in a segue object. And of course, that makes sense because it needs to represent every potential destination view controller. But if this were something where, let's say, you made your own method and that method took the destination view controller as one of its arguments, then you could type it there and have it be exactly what you need in your method. Instead, you have to maybe cast it or whatever.
Yeah, it's important that it is actually an id. It isn't like, say, a UI view controller, which I think that's actually probably gives us a little bit of benefit there, because casting id to whatever is, you know, no warnings there, and you're going to be casting this every single time you use it.
Right. Well, you know, you couldn't. Yeah. You is that true? If you use id, it. I'm trying to remember what Arc does. I think Arc doesn't complain with ID, and it does with if you have another type that can't actually handle. So I'm sure that that's why they did it. that way because it's really the only way to make it work. But it's still, it's a bit unfortunate. So it's good to hear that you've been trying it out. I know that I will be trying it out as well. And I think, again, as I said last time around, now's a good time to do it because most people who are still supporting older versions of the OS are going back to iOS 5, which does support storyboards. So I am planning on trying it myself in one of the next couple revisions of the app I work on at work, if I can, and to see what it does to kick the tires. But the other thing that I can say is that we're looking at the flaws of it, the downsides of it. But the other side of this is that, especially from looking at Apple's WWDC presentation about this, it's pretty obvious that they're putting all of the new features, the new whiz-bangy, effort-saving capabilities of Interface Builder into this format instead of into Zips. So that's going to be the carrot to get you to switch over to do this stuff.
Yeah.
So even if you don't like it, you may still have to use it.
One storyboard per view controller, right?
Well, I have actually heard people talk about doing that.
It seems like a pretty bad idea.
Right, but if you do have these problems with merging, if you do have, you know, very similar problems to Zibs, then it's what you need to do. But I would imagine that it would be pretty difficult because the whole point of storyboards is that you connect things up and then you don't have to worry about putting a lot of extra glue code to make sure they all work. And I would assume that storyboards aren't architected to be easy to hook up to other storyboard files. I would assume that all the magic takes place if everything's in the same file. But I don't know. So I better shut up then. So that'll be it for my feedback. For now, or excuse me, my follow-up. So any other thoughts?
Okay, so you did your 42 minutes of feedback, so now I can start with my hour of feedback. Oh, wait, I better not do that. No, I think I'm pretty much interjected as you went, so I'm all done on my side too.
So the thing that we didn't get to was them talking about the way that so I was looking at one of the Rich Hickey presentations,
right,
that you talked about in a previous episode, mm-hmm. and actually episode 19 in the Magical World of Threads, and that got me thinking about an old C++ technique of standard swap. Have you heard of standard swap?
I have.
Yeah. So that might be something to talk about in a future episode if I can stretch it out, or maybe something to talk about in a blog post. And then also another thing that you won't be hearing from me right now is the talking about letterpress UI. You talk about letterpress UI is very spare, and so I have some thoughts about that.
Oh, so when you say we won't hear from you on this, does it mean never, or do you mean just give us a cliffhanger and now we're going to have to wait?
It's a cliffhanger, and I will probably talk about it in blog posts, and then if the blog posts are extensive enough, then I may bring it back here and do a full talk on it.
That wow, 360.
Yep. Okay, so you can visit our website, edgecasesshow.com, all one word, for show notes, a link to our podcast on iTunes, and more. And you can find us on Twitter, me, A. Pontius, APONTIOUS, which is also my username on app.net, and Wolf, his last name, Wrench, that's the word rent, RANT, plus Z, plus SCH. We'll see you next time.